Any one of these definitions, such as the definition for communication, is a process. Anything of a chart of attitudes, top and bottom scale, could be made into a process. The thing for you to know is definitions. But we're not even really here to learn definitions. We're here to make it possible for you to produce a new being. We are not here for you to overhaul and patch up an old one. The goal of Scientology today doesn't have anything to do with repair crews. That is a fine way, however, of attracting attention, and it is one of the steps of liberation. An individual's superiority to a machine or any object is demonstrated by the fact that he can change its state. If he can change its state, for better or for worse, he's demonstrated his superiority. This is so hard to do on a constructive, creative side that man rather uniformly changes the state of things by blowing them up. If you were to leave a house unguarded, some distance from other houses and so forth, you would come back sooner or later, maybe in 1 month, maybe in 2 or 3, but certainly sometime, you would find that it had had its windows burst in and its boards torn up and so forth. That nobody has come along and planted a new rose arbor. This would be unheard of. In order to be fully conversant with the business of existence, you have to assume a state of mind where you at once could either plant a rose arbor around a vacant house or knock the windows in. Matter of free choice, just willingness to do so. If you went compulsively out on either line, you would violate the most primary definition which we have. I'm going to talk to you about that primary definition for a moment, since we've just talked about survive as what life is doing. There's a theory called the Theta Mess theory. And this theory, oh, I just remembered something. The original statement of the Theta Mess theory was never published, never even put down in notes. But the original statement of it, and which I think I used later on once in a while, the first statement of it was, a no motion is impinged upon an all motion. And these two things coming together combine into medium, erratic, or controlled motions. That's the Theta Mess theory. Theta is the Greek word for thought, and it was necessary to define what thought was, since there were no real definitions for it. And when we said messed, we were referring mainly to the physical universe, which is a universe and was conceived at that time to be chaos. A very interesting sub-theories developed out of this is such a thing as enmest, which is messed which has been organized and which has then been interpolated. And then there's something called entheta. Now you still hear that word surviving. It is thought which was once organized, but which has been interpolated. Enturbulated thought. And that means entheta. Just coined words. But the original theory, the Theta Mess theory, was actually a no motion acting upon an all motion. And this was a better dynamic description of what was going on than others, and so it became very workable. Now, this became refined sooner or later to a very exact definition of this thing called theta. Theta is, of course, just a letter in the Greek alphabet, which traditionally, for the Greeks, stood for thought. And a further examination of this actually discovered that something of this character, such an item as this, could be best described as having no wavelength, having no mass, having no location in space, and having no position in the past, present, or future. And that is a definition of a static. And that is the first definition of a static which is known to the field of physics. Now, that definition is not yet known very widely to physics. Physicists here and there pick it up and look at it and gag slightly, because the first thing they will tell you is, well, of course there's such a thing as a static. All a static is something held in an equilibrium of forces. Oh, no, it's not. You can disprove this to them immediately. You can say, all right, set up a problem whereby something is in an equilibrium of forces, And they say, well, ball sitting there on the table, that's an equilibrium of forces. The table's pushing up and the ball is pushing down, and so it's an equilibrium. You say, yes, and it happens to be moving at 1,000 miles an hour just by reason of being on the surface of the Earth. Because any spot on the surface of the Earth is moving at 1,000 miles an hour. There are seven other directions that that static, which you have just pointed out as being in an equilibrium of forces, seven other directions it's traveling, incident to its being part of the solar system. And so, there blows up the physicist's static, and the actual static has to be moved in under it. As soon as this is done, by the way, the science of physics begins to clarify, and clarifies enormously the second you define space. Space is a viewpoint of dimension. And as soon as you say that, the science of physics begins to be a science. I don't mean to be snide and say the boys have been working without a science, because they have had something which worked finitely when applied within very rigid limits, like fulcrum's balances, that sort of thing. But they rode on out there toward an atom bomb, and they came to the end of their tether. They ran out of definitions. Before they invented the atom bomb, somebody should have taken a slight glance at the Encyclopedia Britannica, which in 1885 said that physics would make its greatest advances when, at last, it had a definition for space and a definition for time. And furthermore, that these definitions were in the province of psychology and did not properly belong in the field of physics, and said that physics was waiting upon psychology in order to do something. And we got some character by the name of Wundt, who in 1876 applied, or some such date, applied the scientific method, he said, to human behavior. Even William James remarks on this factor that time and space are mental conditions and problems. Every psychologist of note anywhere along the line has remarked upon this factor. And every psychologist of note or no note has completely ignored his chief responsibility. And every physicist, every single physicist, including Newton, and all the rest of the boys, have fallen flat on their faces by not establishing the basic conditions of what they were dealing with. They have started from an unreasonable assumption. They've assumed that somebody knew what space was, and have gone on from there. And they've decided that somebody knew what a static was, and they've gone on from there. And of course, they'd wind us up in trouble sooner or later with a thing like an atom bomb. Naturally, they'd wind us up in trouble because they didn't know where they were proceeding. This is not an indictment, you understand, of science at large. It's just hoping it will perish soon. Because if this is the scientific method, to start with unreasonable assumptions and never discover what your definitions are before you proceed into a problem, then we want nothing to do with the scientific method, and you actually are then not following the scientific method, because that is the scientific method. You're really not dealing then in the field of science, if the field of science is what we have had in psychology and physics, because then we are not dealing with this. Because we do this, and there are a new set of principles established here. And the only thing you could call them, I guess, would be a Scientological method. As unhandy as Scientology becomes when you start to add suffixes to it. That is, you make no assumptions without definitions. You use no terms which are not defined. You relate all theory to human experience or living experience. Relate all theory to living experience. If it doesn't add up in the world of livingness, blow it up, throw it away. No good. And it does not permit a definition to be defined in terms of its own parts. It doesn't permit, then, a definition to be a number of descriptive words which are defined by each other. It never permits a definition to be so established. So let's look at that, let's look that over, as the conditions of a new methodology. rather than an old thinkingness. We are not dealing with anything called logic. Logic is something that came up in the days of Aristotle. It was codified very heavily in his day. We are not dealing with this as we know it, logic. We are dealing with gradient scales of related facts. If that's logic, all right, but we have had to redefine logic to use logic. Gradient scales of related facts. And we are subjecting ourselves here to a discipline so much more arduous than the discipline of physics that if a physicist were to examine it, he would at first be rather appalled. He would try to throw it back in your face. He would try to run away. He would try to scoff at it. He'd probably try to say that it didn't come out of Cornell or something in order to get rid of it, but he would never quite be able to sit down to his drawing board or his test tube or whatever a physicist does these days, or his bicarbonate of soda. Come to think about it, the physicist dealing with the government probably sits down to his bicarbonate of soda three times a day. That's probably what he does. He'd never be able to get this shake loose from these assumptions. Now, I'm not talking now about our definitions of things. I'm just talking about the discipline of thinkingness in which Scientology exists. And believe me, that is rarefied air. That lays down a discipline which is superior to the discipline of physics, vastly superior to the discipline of chemistry, and so different from anything related in the past to the field of psychology that you can't relate the two subjects. You cannot relate psychology and Scientology. Somebody will come along and he'll say, the psychologists have known that for a long time. You just be real perky. Just say, well, what have psychologists known all this time? What did you just say? And he'll say, well, go ahead. What did psychologists know all this time? Well, he said, just like you said a moment ago. Don't echo it for him. Just leave him hanging there looking embarrassed. Because this is their standard trick. You say, the mind, let's get very basic, 1947. The mind is composed to resolve problems for the organism relating to survival. Now, that would be the function of what we call a brain. And anything. Oh, he would say, why? Psychology has known that for a long time. Right, don't forget to do this trick to him. Don't let yourself get plowed under and lose an argument in that fashion. Just make nothing out of him fast. And you say, all right, what has psychology known for a long time? He'll say, oh, that. And you say, what did I just say? Because that is the psychological method. Just echo everything. That's all. If you read a fact in this place, then multiply it into that place, and then collect it in another place, and if somebody else has said it, then you put it in another place, but then you cross-relate it in another index, and you file it somewhere else. Then you conduct an experiment where you have presupposed the result, tabulate the fact that you have found the result, forget to put the result down, and call it a scientific method. You think I'm being sarcastic now. I don't happen to be sarcastic. I'm being absolutely, factually truthful. This statement on the part of Mr. Wundt was a very, very good statement. He said, now I'm going to apply the scientific method to the field of human behavior. But get how different his discipline was from the discipline under which you operate. Get how different these two disciplines are. He did not impose upon himself now the necessity to establish, define, and state the scientific method. See, he says, I'm now going to apply the scientific method to the field of human mind and behavior. Now, our discipline would immediately necessitate that if we were going to do this, we'd have to look it over now and find everything undefined in the problem. Everything undefined. And we'd define it. We'd find there was a word down there at the end of one of the sentences, and we didn't know what the hell it was. That would immediately then check us from jumping off from that point until we'd established that word. You see that? Now, it was perfectly all right in the sloppy discipline of 1876 and 1955, wherever psychology is operating, to simply say, well, we apply the scientific method. The first definition in print on the scientific method is long after Professor Wundt. And it is long, long after people had used it threadbare, and is not an accurate or correct statement. The scientific method which is used today was discussed with the engineers at Bell Laboratories, Ma Bell, at lunch hours until they had finally decided what they were doing. Here we let somebody decide what he was doing instead of deciding what was so. And we found out that the scientific method, in their understanding, was so and so and so and so. But in discussing it for a few lunch hours, they had established a brand new scientific method. They had made a better definition out of it than had existed before. And that scientific method, which they then defined, ran this way. They take a theory or a datum which predicts where new data will be found, which, when looked for, will be found to exist in fact. In other words, scientific method is a system of prediction used by entering on this basis. Well, something may be so. Now, let's see if any data exists to demonstrate it. Why, then this theory has some validity and possibly will predict some more data. Now we'll go look for that new data and find out if it exists anyplace. And if that exists, this theory is getting pretty good. And we'll see if it predicts some more data. And if it predicts some more data, by golly, that's getting pretty good. And if it doesn't predict all the data that we did find, then there's something wrong with the theory, so we get a new theory. See? And we refine the theory and go ahead from there. Now that actually is a refined statement of the scientific method as of 1950. And if any invention is connected with it, it is the engineers at Bell Labs. Now, you'll find people who every once in a while will tell you why the scientific method is all written up in, oh, there's a big mention of it or something. You go and look at that publication. Yes, yes, yeah, it's written up. It says the scientific method, and then skips it. In other words, the discipline in this field called science did not match the word called science. The discipline did not match the word called science, because science means truth. It is taken from the word scio, S-C-I-O, which is knowing in the fullest sense of the word. That's quote-unquote. Scio means knowing in the fullest sense of the word. And so there you have, of course, in knowingness, you have at once the combination of truth and knowledge. And if science then was interested in truth and knowledge fully, they never would have shilly-shallied up the line any place and excused themselves one way or another lamely by saying what? That the problem of the human mind was too complex to solve. You find that statement repeated over and over, book after book, year after year, clear back to 1876. Any unit which operates on the basis that its goal cannot be achieved must be operating in an apathy. Let's get that clearly, that any organization which operates on the basis that its problem is unsolvable, or its goal cannot be achieved, must perforce be operating in an apathy. They assumed, before they ever started to solve the problem could not be solved. And so we get to the first and foremost discipline, which we have in Scientology, which was the first postulate on the track of Dianetics and Scientology. And a very early postulate, 1932. This whole work was done succeeding the postulate, the problem of the human mind is sufficiently simple to be solved. Now, that's the basic postulate on the line. Now, get this clearly. What importance in a preclear is this thing called a basic postulate? You can see that. The preclear attaches enormous importance to the postulates he makes. Isn't that true? Well, get the whole field of psychology operating on the postulate that they couldn't solve their problem. And now do you want to classify Scientology and psychology? The whole field of physics was operating on the postulate that it couldn't solve its problems until psychology had solved the problem. What kind of an apathy is this that follows in succession to another apathy? So where was this thing called the scientific method, and where was science? And the question can well be asked, not perfunctorily or pompously or anything of the sort, but for your own orientation, the question can be asked, was there any science in this society? Or was it simply a system of trial and error which had been dignified into a pomposity called science? Now that is something you can actually use to split apart an enormous amount of preconceived information. If you'll just look at what was psychology, what's physics, what have they done with these things, have they reached any zenith, is their methodology something which I am using? If you can answer those questions just by answering them, just by seeing it clearly, not just emotionally, but just by knowing this material, by looking around in the world and seeing there's some truth in this, you immediately are higher up and further out on a road that leads somewhere. And on that road, there may be a point called civilization, but no civilization can exist in the absence of science. No civilization can exist in the absence of a science of mind. No civilization can exist in the absence of a science of the physical universe, both of which must be based to exist upon reasonable, fully defined assumptions. You can't go wandering around in the dark and arrive at any civilization. No, you arrive somewhere else when you start, let's be colloquial about it, when you start kidding the society. When you start kidding yourself and kidding the society that it has solved a great many things when it hasn't. That it possesses an enormous amount of technology, which it doesn't. You wind up a society at the only place you can wind it up, the end of the cycle of action of the mass universe, destruction. And there is where the society stops. And it stops without ever really having gotten started. Because what would a society be which was totally dependent on other determinism to consistently and continually create its beingness? In other words, dependent on just the whim of fate, whether it lived or died. You'd say that was a society which was in the field of superstition. Maybe luck will get us through. So we must have been living in the dark ages of superstition all the way along the line, and only believing that we weren't simply because people said so loudly we weren't. This has been called an enlightened age. And it is an age which has found born in this society the tools of its destruction. And if we in Scientology were entirely muzzled, it would never have grasped the tools of creation. Never. This is the sole forward push on the field of creation. That makes a sort of a sad, lonely one, sort of a complex, doesn't it, for all of us? But nevertheless, it's quite true that this push is not something to make people's minds better. It's not something that just makes people hopeful or patches up some decayed or decrepit bodies. That isn't what this business of Scientology is all about. We have a bear by the tail, whether we like it or not. This is the sole forward motion in the direction of a creative beginning cycle of action for a society, launched in the teeth of a society which has as its highest accomplishment the invention of its suicide weapon, the atom bomb. Its highest accomplishment was the development of a gun with which to blow out its brains. Now, if you looked at a pre-clear and saw him in that state, you would say, good heavens, what on earth we have here. Now, if we are true to what we are trying to do, and if we gaze broadly at our goals, we find out that our goal is not then, pre-clear. That isn't our goal. Our goal is broader than that. And well pre-clears and startling results simply serve to attract a sufficient attention on the part of a society to slam home the data which they are missing and which they need desperately to put themselves back together again. If we can make the society alert to the existence of a body of knowledge which can keep its wheels turning by making people well, voila, we'll make people well. But this is not a basic goal, and any practitioner in Scientology who gets pinned down to the belief that he is a practitioner in the field of healing had better not forget what he's a practitioner in the field of healing of. He's a practitioner in the field of healing of a society. And this is an awfully big chunk of responsibility. It's real big. And it's not easily won. Because if you've ever tried to hold down somebody who's trying to take poison, or a snake in his death throes, you'll get the idea of how you can get kicked around by an organism whose self-destruction you're trying to interrupt. You can get kicked around violently. You don't have to expect to get kicked around, but if you don't predict that you're sooner or later, now and then, going to be booted around some, that you're going to look like you lose as well as look like you win, you're not predicting accurately. The mission of the Scientologist is the application of the definitions which he knows to the problems of civilization as they may appear to him. The reason I talked to you about that this last half hour is very, very important, actually, you. Because these two processes, viewpoint, straight wire, be do and have, straight wire, break the back of any case that they're laid into, if they're done as they're done. And if you have sufficient discipline in yourself to recognize how much technology lies behind this and what that technology is good for, if you know that, these processes will work for you very easily. Therapeutic Scientology on this May the 4th, 1954, is a solved problem. Now, you find that out, and then you'll know why I talked to you about you having to practice the role of healer to a society, because a pre-clear is too easy. Thank you.